I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
The ever-demonized and written-off remake is the subject of today's show. Specifically, going back to the mid-2000s, a time when moviegoers might recognize the titles of the movies, but unless you were an avid TV viewer and WB fan, you might not know any of the actors. I was pretty surprised when I started looking at the era and the movies. It's a dense trend. In 2003, we got Texas Chainsaw Massacre, this time directed by Marcus Nispel. Zack Snyder brought us Fast Zombies and the revamped Dawn of the Dead in 2004. Both House of Wax and the Ryan Reynolds Amityville Horror were in 2005. The Hills Have Eyes, 2006. Rob Zombie's Halloween was 2007. 2008, Prom Night got remade, and April Fool's Day went straight to video. In 2009, we got My Bloody Valentine 3D, along with Wes Craven's remade classic Last House on the Left, and the bookending Marcus Nispel's remake of Friday the 13th. Throughout that timeline, we also saw the rise of the American J-horror remakes like The Ring, The Grudge, One Missed Call, but those films are a different animal altogether. Two of the three movies we're going to be talking about here are remakes of what I think of as horror Americana, standards that the fans have made classics. And maybe there's something about that, that return to familiarity. A lot has been written about the cultural wave of nostalgia that followed 9/11. Of course, people wanted to return to a better, more familiar time. I feel like that now. And remakes are still going strong. We are still plenty obsessed with the past. But I think the general consensus is that these movies don't really work. I think in part because the horror movies that land and have an impact are usually ones that challenge taboos and cultural norms of the time. I really think horror movies are one of the ways we as a culture exercise our demons. Once a horror movie hits the mainstream, that conversation goes public. It enters the ether. To paraphrase Mr. Rogers, if it's mentionable, it's manageable. We get over fears and develop new ones. But it's hard to scare us the same way twice. So unless these movies evolve into something else, what are we even doing here? The writer Stephen Hanske wrote, "Remakes demonstrate the triumph of economic over artistic considerations, signaling the creative bankruptcy of a national film industry or a cinematic genre operating within this film industry. Which is to say, they're all out of ideas and the American horror film is dead." And this was a rough patch for sure, but at the same time, this wave of films also brought us the work of a lot of international filmmakers new to making movies in the American system. Marcus Nispel, who directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is from Germany originally. House of Wax director Jaume Colet-Serra is from Spain. And The Hills Have Eyes was remade by Alexandre Aja from France, one half of the duo behind the New French Extremity's High Tension. I don't know if it's ironic or if it makes perfect sense that it would take an outsider to give us fresh eyes through which to see our traditional ideas. Between these movies, there's still a lot to like. And it's not all just Paris Hilton taking a spike to the face.
So today, Darren and I are joined by our friend Tony, who is part of the original Lunch Hour Review. Hi, Tony.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Tony is something of a, I would say, more 90s and then maybe some of the early 2000s horror expert.
Yeah, very 90s, very millennium.
Yeah.
You're a millennial proper.
Yes.
negotiating the terms.
No. So when it comes to the stars of these movies that we're going to talk about today, you knew every single one of them and
exactly.
Like whatever WB show they came off of.
Exactly. Yeah. You watched everything on WB at that point. So.
Of course.
Did you?
Of course.
Yeah. Every episode.
Well, except
of
Seventh Heaven. I hated Seventh Heaven. So. Oh.
I did not watch Seventh Heaven.
And that turned out to be horror. We just didn't know it at the time.
Exactly.
Exactly. Who really knew? You know, they gave Jessica Biel so much crap for trying to change her image and getting out of that show.
Oh, yeah.
And
because
she
was all
trying
goody-goody.
To be too sexy
she was
and
to
all
be
this
sexy
stuff.
Sexy to get out of the show.
And now who was the real bad guy?
Hmm? Exactly.
Yeah. Old father preachy.
So thanks for joining us, Tony, coming all the way from Hollis, right?
Yep.
It's close Tony to Long and Run Island.
Run DMC, exactly.
So I I mean, I know your interest is like, oh, these maybe aren't the greatest of films, but there's just a really great part of me that still very much enjoys all of these films. Yeah. TCM a little less than the others, I will say that. But there's something about me that really loves it because of a nostalgia that I watched all these movies in college. Mm. And this was, you know, a movie that you would rent or go to the theater with all your friends in college. And that's why I think I like it so much.
Yeah, I think it was the same for me. I watched these movies in college and, you know, and for me, I know the actors, most of them at least. So mm-hmm. you kind of relate to them better.
You are who they were like steering towards.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you were I was the target demographic.
I was the audience for them.
The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of five youths. It is all the more tragic in that they were young. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see, as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day. The events of that day were to lead to one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
So we're going to begin with Texas Chainsaw Massacre from 2003, produced by Michael Bay, because that became a thing he wanted
to
do.
There was no explosions, though.
No. There's none? I guess there's none.
No explosions. Explosions of blood.
Yes. Splatters.
Yes,
all
a
over.
Lot of splattering.
Directed by Marcus Nispel, a German filmmaker who I think was primarily known for music videos these days. He's kind of gone back to the well with horror remakes, and they might as well be horror remakes. Written by Scott Kosar, based on the original script by Kim Henkel and Toby Hooper. Starring Jessica Biel, Eric Balfour, who plays Kemper, which...
He's one of those people, though, Eric Balfour, who I know his face, but then I'm like, I don't know apparently anything that
Again,
you've been in.
In the 90s, like he late 90s actor.
I know him from 6 Feet Under. When I first noticed that characters are calling him Kemper... I thought that was a weird moment. It kind of felt like Cube for a moment in terms of like everybody being named for something. And I was hoping everybody else would also be a famous serial killer. But
Wouldn't
no, he's
cool?
the only one. I'm confused why Edmund Kemper is the one reference. Like, not even like Gain.
Right.
I mean, make a specific reference for God's sakes. But
no need.
Not so much. Filling out the cast, we've got Jonathan Tucker. Mm-hmm. Arlie Ermey, who everybody knows from Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
And Andrew Briniarski as Leatherface, a guy who was originally known for being the roided out football player in the program. He played Zangief in Jean-Claude Van Damme's Street Fighter movie.
Yeah.
He's kind of a scumbag. His social media makes it pretty apparent, like on Front Street, that like, yeah, he's kind of a dickhead.
And you're like, where is Kane Hodder at this point in time? Why couldn't he have done this?
Briniarski approached Michael Bay about playing this role, and he kind of begged for it. Like I don't know. He's just a giant lumbering guy. In 2012, he and his girlfriend were arrested for animal cruelty.
Jesus.
And Animal Control was called to remove 25 starving Pomeranians from his trailer.
Pomeranians.
Yeah, he was hoarding Pomeranians.
That's funny. A big giant guy. I mean, it's not funny. It's terrible.
Right.
But a big giant guy with little tiny,
big guy,
fluffy,
small dog.
Yeah. Running all over the place. Yeah.
So Eric Balfour, he came from Dawson's Creek.
Dawson's Creek.
That's right. Oh. 24
Buffy,
as well.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah, he's the friend.
Can't
You're
hardly
so right.
wait. So again,
was
he a 90s
was a
actor.
90s yeah. guy. He really was. Sorry, this is how this episode is going to go. It's going to be like, that's what I know him from.
Okay, so a brief synopsis for the remake for those unfamiliar. After picking up a traumatized young hitchhiker, five friends find themselves stalked and hunted by a deformed, chainsaw-wielding killer and his family of equally psychopathic killers.
Yeah.
That's all one sentence. How do you like that? That's not even two different sentences.
Well, the IMDb doesn't write these. Someone from essentially the production writes it. True statement?
Someone has to put it on IMDb.
Right, but it's like Wikipedia. Can anyone do it? Can I do it?
You would think the studio would assert some amount of control over the tagline, so that I feel like that was approved by at least one person.
Maybe.
But whatever, that one person was a bad writer.
Not an editor, definitely not.
No. But so as far as introing and sort of framing this, I love the intro, the like true crime documentary intro that at first listen sounds authentic as fuck, and it turns out it is because John Larroquette came back to do the intro as he did for the original in 74. Like, that's
that's pretty great. It's
a
good start.
I love John Larroquette. I wish he was like in the show though, because I just loved seeing him. He just like cracks me up. I love the start. It sounds to me though, at the beginning, it's like the town that dreaded sundown in the very beginning.
I was thinking that. Yeah.
So like matter of fact and like, what is that? Like, true crime of the 1970s TV show.
Yes. Yeah. Like unsolved mysteries, that approach. Yeah. So as far as like throwbacks that make it into this movie, the cinematography was also done by Daniel Pearl, who did the original. And for those of you who remember, who have seen the original recently, like part of the reason it's so visceral and immediate, and it was shot like a documentary.
Right.
And that was Tobe Hooper's background. And in previous episodes, I think specifically on indie filmmakers, we kind of nerded out over Texas Chainsaw and why that works as well as it does when it's not actually that bloody. Like, it's actually a movie that takes advantage of, like, shapes and moments and silhouettes. Right. And, yeah,
This one, however, just shows it all. It's totally the opposite. Because you have to think, these films, all of these films, we come out of the 90s, which is pure WB horror. You know your
Wes Craven.
Wes Craven, much. Your Scream kind of stuff, your I Know What You Did.
Urban Legends,
and
yeah.
In France, we know that New Extremity is going wild. And so I think what we get is an Americanized version of it, which is
sort of
is like
mix.
A slasher, but on steroids.
Right.
Yeah, I think Saw would come out in 2004, I think. And so that's the year after this. But yeah, I don't know. It was a strange time. 2003 still, I mean, consider the country had gone through 9/11 and was in the midst of the Iraq War. And when it came to horror at like the turn of the century, like we talked about how Grand Guignol kind of fell out of fashion when people did see like what war meant to humanity, and it was grim and it was gruesome, and that shit wasn't so fun to like make plays about and sort of make light of. But this time we've gone another way. This time we've kind of demanded to see the nitty gritty.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I hate to sound in any way like Tipper Gore, because I'm totally not, but I think it is something that in our society especially, it is advocated to be desensitized to some of this stuff, because you make a better soldier when you're not afraid.
Right. Don't they? Yes. They talk about like running game simulations, but like they play Call
Absolutely.
Of Duty type games to,
you know, really... and I don't want to be like Tipper Gore, because I don't think, you know, terrible movies or video games make you a serial killer or something. But I do think there's a sense of realism removal that comes from it.
Yeah. You lose like the connection or the feeling when you get used to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's dig into this. Firstly, starts off with great Lynyrd Skynyrd. And these guys are going to a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert, which seems like the best thing to do in 1973.
And they're coming up from Mexico with a piñata full of weed.
Yes.
That like, all right, I guess this is what we got for the first, like the car ride is just kind of like a vessel for exposition. We kind of get everybody's breakdown.
Right.
Jessica Alba is pointed out to be
Jessica
the
Biel.
Nerd. Sorry.
Yeah.
Biel. Jessica Biel.
Have I been calling her Jessica Alba? I don't think so.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I just heard that.
They are two different people.
Yeah. Jessica Biel is kind of the square. I guess there was a subplot that I don't know if it got filmed, but...
Is she pregnant?
Right. Part of the reason that they were in Mexico was for her to get an abortion, which links it to House of Wax in terms of, like, the Paris Hilton pregnancy scare.
But
that
then she doesn't get an abortion because she's not drinking and she's not smoking. I figured she was pregnant, right? You can kind of figure she's pregnant.
Right. And it would initiate an interesting plot point if, like, now she is trying to protect herself and her unborn kid, but the story doesn't go there, and so we never have any extra
reason. She just seems like straight edge, or kind of like a bitch.
She seems like a goody two shoe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not in a good way.
Yeah, but like, how is she friends with all these people if she's such a...
That's, yeah.
Right, everyone's smoking, everyone's having a good
time.
She's
essentially me in high school. I was everything short of the black X on the back of my hand, but I was abstaining from all things, namely fun. Early in the movie, in sort of Leatherface's workshop, we see the head of Harry Knowles, the founder of Ain't It Cool News. It's just, I guess the film was made outside of Austin, and he's kind of, well, at least he was before he was kind of outed publicly as being kind of a scumbag. He was a pivotal figure in the Austin film community. And so a nice throw to him is the like head on the tray. But it doesn't add anything. It's just kind of a conspicuous fat head on a tray early in the movie.
Yeah, it didn't mean anything to me until you told me what it was. And I go, oh,
yeah,
that's
I'm like,
good.
Oh, okay, sure.
It's like guy's head, don't care.
Yeah, so in the original, it's just kind of a lunatic guy who cuts himself with a knife, right? Like, it's a dude who gets on in the van in the original. Mm-hmm. Here, it's been Michael Bade, so it's a very pretty blonde girl who's kind of muttering to herself and traumatized and
needs like, chapstick.
Clearly in shock. Priorities.
And a new wardrobe.
But so they pick up a stranger on the side. I guess it's more realistic to pick up a young woman off the side of the road than some strung out junkie looking dude.
Of course.
But in any case, she's kind of muttering. She was clearly walking away from something. And so when they encounter her going the opposite way, they put her in the van and then keep going in the direction they were going back towards whatever she was walking away from. And eventually that she notices.
Go back there. You can't make me go back there. I won't go back.
Back where?
He's a bad man. He's a really bad man. Oh my God. He's a bad man.
Oh, shit.
Oh. You're all gonna die.
Grab it! Oh.
And then makes a scene, and then
and
pulls...
And then makes a scene. I like it how she's
it's
bad
just
her
a scene.
Making a scene, drama queen, whatever.
Well, like, as the viewer initially, we don't know why she's having such an adverse reaction, but then it becomes apparent that, like, oh, she doesn't want to go that way, and so she pulls... Not just a loaded, but a cocked revolver from between her legs.
Yeah.
And this is the first we're seeing.
She's been
with
walking with
up
that
there.
Up there. Yeah, exactly.
It's as if she like remembered in the car. She's like, oh,
she's
yeah.
Like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've got this.
I
forgot.
This might have been useful for self-defense, and perhaps it was even used.
She's like, what's going on down there? Oh, it's this gun I forgot about.
My issue is that it's first revealed, like the hammer's pulled back, like it's cocked. That is...
Very
I mean,
dangerous.
I've seen like gun safety faux pas, but this is the worst I've ever seen.
My thought is, how could that happen, right? But I guess it can, and it recently did.
Yeah.
Really?
There was a woman arrested. I wish I remembered if it was here in New York. I don't think it was, but she was doing a prison visit. Upon inspection, she seemed to have a loaded revolver in her vagina. Yeah. Although I guess it was like a clip-style semi-auto. So it was smaller, more compact than what is here.
Like a 38.
It looks like a 38, right? Yeah. It's a pretty sizable
pretty
gun.
It's pretty big for that gun up her.
And the explosion that happens from it is pretty forceful.
Yes.
Yeah. It is spoiler territory, but it kind of happens in the first couple minutes of the movie, so we can't really spoil that.
Right.
She puts the gun in her mouth and blows her brains out, surprise to everybody.
But I'm just like seeing this and I'm thinking to myself, like, why do I even carry a purse if I could carry everything?
Well, I don't know how she held it up in her dress.
I mean, it was in there.
It was really in there.
But that was a great shot, though, the way that it was shot. Of how
where it pulls out from the van
through her head.
Yeah. That was freaking awesome. Brilliant.
That was pretty great. That it reminded brilliant. Me.
I think that was the best part of the movie, actually.
Really?
I thought there was a dope shot of her just like still head and her lips with a little bit of smoke
coming out.
Oh, yes,
that
that's
whole
cool
scene
too.
Was so freaking good.
It was all creepy. About her, the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, everything else was all get about
for Tony from there.
Fiend. And that would have been the very end of the
movie. Awesome movie.
There's
Jessica
no chainsaws.
Biel,
there's
Jessica
no massacre.
Biel, she's being a stuck-up bitch. I expect that. That's great. Everything's everything.
You could care less about her, I think.
Exactly.
So the little kid from the Ring remake, David Dorfman, is here playing Jedediah.
Yes.
A little redneck boy with comically large teeth.
Oh, that's where he is from. No wonder he looks so familiar.
Yeah. I guess the year before he had been in the Ring.
He's a creeper.
What'd you do to her?
Huh?
The girl out there. In the van.
We didn't do anything to her. She did that to herself.
And I guess he was meant to have a larger role in this movie, but that was also cut down.
I kind of wish he did.
Me too. Suicide Girl and then this little kid.
Yeah, would make the movie done.
Fine.
That's it.
Yeah. I could have done with less Arlie Ermey. He's someone who, in Full Metal Jacket, I appreciate his role because it's powerful. It's a groundbreaking role, him as the drill sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
In this, he is authentically creepy and fucked up. Like, it really bothers... You know what? It's the chewing tobacco.
That's just an educated guess, but... My money says your dead body's right there in that van.
When someone can chew tobacco and just have it, like, kind of spewed up on their lip comfortably and without any, like, sense of self, like, that's the sign of a sociopath. Like, that's that's someone to steer clear from.
I love his eyebrows. He has those, like, crazy old man eyebrows.
That, like, go up.
Yeah.
That goes all over the place, like, kind of. It's long and thick.
He's, like, so authentic. He really was a soldier, and that's where he comes from. And I kind of don't know how much he's really acting and how much of those characters is just really him.
I think he enjoys playing the villain. He used to have a TV show where he would just, like, answer people's military questions and whatnot. So, like, he loves being a ham. That is for sure. But, yeah, he is accessing something that is, like... It's just, I don't know, it's alien to me, and it really sets me off. It really skeeves me out.
It's not alien to me. If you grew up where I grew up, that's not an unusual occurrence. It's not an unusual
spitting tobacco,
person.
Like, on your own shoe.
Yeah, that's actually not that strange.
But he really set up his own character just by that spit right when you meet him.
Yeah.
And you knew exactly what kind of guy he was going to be.
Yeah, because this guy's not even using a can. He's just spitting it and sit wherever it goes.
Back to the earth.
Like, Jesus, very nitty gritty.
So before we even meet him, though, our little group of friends drops off at a diner, tries to get help. Things are not going well from the very beginning. Nothing makes sense. And I don't know if it's just in 1973, things just didn't make sense and everyone just said that's okay. But to me, like, nothing is making sense. And I'm thinking, I would get the fuck out of here. When they want to dump that girl's body in the very beginning... I might have been for that. It's 1973. No one knows.
No one would find out.
Dump it out.
It is interesting how many of the characters are okay with that idea. That, like, we didn't know her. We didn't kill her. Let's just dump her on the side of the road.
I feel in the 70s that would have been okay. Do you think? Maybe we should have found someone in the 70s.
You clear the, like, whatever borderlines, and then you call and be like, I think I saw a mannequin by the side of the road. You guys should investigate that. And then it's... off your, and this place apparently is also off the grid enough that they just get away with all kinds of shit. Did you guys see the prequel by any chance? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the beginning?
No.
Who was in that one?
Matt Bomer, I think, it's one of the dudes.
I think it's Matt Bomer.
Was that with Jordana Brewster too?
Yes.
Yes, I did see that one.
She was in everything. Whatever happened to her?
I didn't know her. I only recently started watching the Fast and Furious series, and I was like, she was a big to-do.
I'm going to just let that slide that you're watching the Fast and the Furious.
I know, right?
Right?
It's not really for me. Whatever.
Sure.
It was for Rachel. I'm going to put it on her.
Rachel loves Fast and Furious.
Never mind. Jordana Brewster, you guys. No, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre prequel, it sort of shows us how the family comes to this place. Arlie Ermey isn't actually any sort of, sheriff. Of course not. Like, he just stole the uniform in the cop car and he's been pretending ever since.
Right.
But in any case, that movie is not very good. Although Matt Bomer, they suppose that he is the first face that Leatherface puts on.
That's a handsome face. It's a good choice.
That's a good one.
Not so good when it's stretched out across...
Yeah, Thor looked gross too when he was all stretched out.
That was awesome though.
Spoiler alert. Do we want to? I'll beep that out. That's fine. But that is a great reveal though. That is my favorite moment in the movie where he kind of like, it's almost as if he knows he's on camera.
Yeah, he's like
whips, turns to look and make eye contact.
It's like a surprised face.
My thought though is, would a face, if you tore it off, still look the same as like your face? Because it doesn't have your bones underneath it. It would just, I think, be a, I don't know if you could still tell it was me if my face was ripped off.
It would just be like landmarks, like beauty marks, scars, that kind of thing that you're associating with, I guess, right? Because it does require your musculature,
bone
your
structure,
bone structure.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That it,
Let me hit you guys with some interesting skin facts, actually, right now. Not just about skin. I was looking up, you know, and I'm probably going to be flagged. Who fucking knows now? But I was looking up, you know, people who wear people's skin, things like that.
As you do.
You know, as you do, as you Google it 2 o'clock in the morning, like any normal human being. What I noticed, though, is a lot of killers who do skin people or flay people are mostly women. It's actually not a lot of men. And it's kind of interesting, too, because Ed Gein, you know, would only take women's body parts and he was making a woman's suit. So that's kind of interesting.
Famously had mother issues.
Clearly, you know, TCM is off of Ed Gein and everyone who listens to the show knows how much I love them. in a disgusting, disgusting way. But this is a story from Australia. A woman named Catherine Knight was sentenced. She's a modern killer. In 2000 is when she got sentenced for killing her boyfriend. She ended up butchering parts of his body. She hung him on meat hooks, very TCM, and skinned him and then served up the meat with a baked potato, pumpkin, zucchini, cabbage, yellow squash, and gravy.
Aside from this meat part, I think that actually sounds decent.
Yeah, it sounds like a Blue Apron meal minus the human.
Well, here's the thing.
And probably cheaper, too.
She had invited his kids over for dinner and had set the food all up with place cards for each of the kids. And they were going
to eat their own father?
Yeah.
Wow. Wait, they were supposed to eat, but they
did they
didn't?
She got caught before then. No, no one came for this dinner party. They came. The police came before the dinner party started.
Is it creepy of me to say I'm a little disappointed that they didn't? Actually, to eat the father.
Yeah, Tony. Thanks for joining us.
That's fucked up, Tony. This is why you're on the show. Then there was another one. Lots of women doing this. This one here, we've talked about on the show before. Mary Bell, 11-year-old killer.
Yeah.
Kills two little boys. She also more did mutilating and gloving their penises instead of, or degloving their penises instead of all of their skin and flaying them entirely. But that's kind of a common link.
I didn't know that part of it.
Yeah.
She was really young. What?
11 years old.
11, Jesus.
11 years old.
I just like to know how these women or people know how to de-skin people, skin people.
Yeah, no.
That's like
beyond some hunter
stuff. That's a talent, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, people pay, like people do the hunting and then just hand over their deer and they're like, give me the good parts.
Right.
And then some professional, that's their job is to dismantle and skin a deer. But in this case,
Without ruining.
Well, I guess like you prepare enough chickens, right? Like what more
like,
do you need to know?
With deer parts, I would think like you don't want to ruin the skin. Cause
I think skin is very tough though. So I think you could probably peel it like an orange. I don't know. Let me tell you about my last favorite skin cutter upper. 14-year-old kid named Sandy Charles, and this is the best part about it. It's not. It's terrible. This is terrible. These are real people, and it's a terrible thing. Anyway, he killed a 7-year-old kid by luring him into the bushes. Nice. He skins him and then boils the skin so that he can reduce the fat to a liquid. And people were like, why did you do that? And it's because he saw the movie, the Julian Sands movie, Warlock. And that's what inspired him. So maybe Tipper Gore was onto something.
Just wanted to try it out?
Well, in the movie Warlock, they boil skin down for this liquid and then it makes them fly. And so essentially he wanted to fly. And that's what he did. So that's some people to look up.
I can't believe how young these people are, though.
Because those are crazy thoughts. And I think kids would be like, I saw this
on
TV.
Over the place, right?
Yeah.
What's the line from Scream is that movies don't make people into psychopaths, it makes psychopaths more creative.
Yeah. So, you know, when I get arrested for looking up things like this, at least you all get some information from that.
Except I'm going to edit this out of the show, so you're on your own. But yeah, I've got to note that Jessica Biel does so much running over this movie that I had to look it up. I'm pretty sure this inspired the Nike commercial where a woman under threat throws on her Nikes and then just hauls ass.
Yeah.
And outruns the chainsaw-wielding
I
masked
that
figure.
Commercial.
That was a great commercial.
That
it
speaks
was so
to me
good.
Because I'm not going to run for any other fucking reason.
You might like the Zombies Run app that sort of feeds into your ear a narrative about,
I don't like anything about running.
She will not run unless she has to.
Oh, yeah. I can't even run down the block.
Jessica Biel seems to have... trained for this, and then like a pro athlete, we are seeing all the work that led into this because she effectively outruns Leatherface a couple of times.
Yes.
A lot, yeah.
And her character, we know that she's a goody-goody, and she, did cross-country track in high school.
But she's not a goody-goody because, remember, she went to juvie.
She did.
And
she
that's where she
that.
Learns to do the cars.
Yes.
I forgot about that.
Yes,
so
she did.
Why is she... Maybe she's on parole.
And she picked locks.
Yeah, she can pick locks and she can do the hot wiring.
Like hot
and she
wire
said
car.
She learned it in juvie because I made a note and I said, LOL, Jessica Biel in juvie. That's so lame.
I don't buy it. What was the other? Oh, I guess there was a nod to the original about a knife
her
that
knife.
She has, and she got it from her brother. And in the original, the brother gives the sister a knife. Yeah, I don't know. Minor note that I think most people probably wouldn't notice. I didn't notice.
I just didn't care. This out of the three movies, this one is my least favorite. Least.
Yeah, there's not really, even Jessica Biel is not much to latch onto and sort of invest in any of the characters. Yeah.
So I made this crazy note. So this movie, when I think of this movie, though, this is one of the few movies, actually there's a scene in each one of these movies that are very rare to me where my stomach actually turns from violence. Ah. And this movie has one of those scenes that I still think about pretty much any time I watch a scary movie when I think of really horrific things. And it's... my gets taken, and he's on these meat hooks, and they just balance him right above the piano, and his toes are barely touching, and every time Jessica Biel tries to help him, he slides back down. She makes it worse. It's horrific. It's horrific. And I wrote a little note where he was just tapping on the piano with his toes, and I wrote, Mike Vogel on the piano, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, good old Twinkle Toes.
And I was really proud of myself about that because, oh my God, it makes you want to vomit.
Yes, it does.
Twinkle Five Toes, because at that point, Leatherface has taken one of his legs.
Yes.
And I couldn't really figure it out for myself. But Leatherface also takes a handful of seeming rock salt.
Mm-hmm.
And mashes that into his stump.
For fun.
Yes.
I don't know that would stop bleeding. I think it's a little too early to be trying to cure meat. So I'm not
you
sure why salt in the wound.
He would burn that stump if he was going to do that.
Sure.
Yeah, he would cauterize it, you would think. Which I learned from Boondock Saints.
Maybe it was just him being cruel. Maybe he was just kind of I like it when you scream.
But he doesn't seem to be a torture person. Not
no,
that I
it
see
doesn't
that.
Seem like he cares
no,
about
no,
that.
No, he's kind of got the precision of a butcher.
I'm just going to kill.
Generally.
I'm going to slash and kill.
Well,
maybe
I
he's
noticed...
hard of hearing. Maybe he doesn't even notice the screams. He just puts the guy on the hook and he's that's where
be.
You live now.
Oh. That could be.
I mean, he's missing part of...
He doesn't have real ears, so maybe...
Or nose. This is the first time we see Leatherface without the mask, and it's a bad CG moment, but we do see that he's missing his nose.
Yeah.
So, he can't hear well, he can't smell well. I'd be pretty cranky.
That's not true, though, because he can hear pretty well, because when Jessica Biel is hiding from him... Because I was thinking to myself, you should just hide from him, because he has no peripherals, because he's wearing someone's face on his face.
That's true.
And he probably couldn't hear that well, but he can, because when the rats make some noise...
He heard the rat.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
So he must have supersonic hearing.
You go straight to supersonic? He doesn't just have mortal...
from hearing? From
the
normal hearing to supersonic?
The rats were very quiet. The rats were whispering, and still he was what was that?
Well, they weren't whispering, because they weren't meow, because of... Jessica Biel pushing them off, but...
Did you make them... the rat just made a Mew sound like that one Pokemon?
Yes.
Mew!
Don't give me any crap, young lady. God damn it, I got just as much respect for a dead body as anybody around here. Hey!
nasty goddamn thing out of the back seat of my goddamn car. Put it in the trunk. What the hell's the matter with you?
You guys didn't think Jessica Biel was very good in this. I thought she played drunk and or drugged very well.
I guess that was fine.
I guess someone hits her with a proper injection. Oh God, can you imagine where that syringe has been?
No, they drink tea.
Oh, it's in the tea. I am thinking of House of Wax. I'm already blurring them in my head. In this case, Jessica Biel
drinks the tea
from the family.
Oh, I
from
thought
the two women,
which she should have known as soon as she walked in there. Don't go to a trailer in the middle of the woods.
Like, at this scene, she's met a couple of them all over the place, not just in one area.
Right.
So she knows sort of, like, this whole place
is wrong.
Right. No one seems to be right. And then she runs into these two women, and she doesn't realize something seems to be wrong with them, too.
It takes her a while.
In the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. It takes her a while. After she got drugged, then she's like, oh, wait, whoops.
Right.
Then
the
phone rings.
That no one is taking her... like angry paranoia seriously is the first tip off. And then they introduce the idea that, I don't know, someone stole a baby. I'm guessing it belonged to the lady in the first scene.
Yeah.
Gun in the vagina.
Yeah.
Replace that baby with the gun.
Maybe that's why there was some extra room in there.
She just had the baby and now she's
in the
extra room.
That was a big baby though.
But so when she's drugged, Leatherface brings her back to the house and throws her down the stairs into the basement that's got about like almost a foot of water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, like that's where it's like, oh, right, it's a Michael Bay movie. Her shirt is wet. Oh, you can see through. Except not so much. It's just kind of inexplicable why their basement would be flooded. And
well, that's what
kind of
jumped
his
to me
area.
Throughout the whole movie. The only thing I can really, really remember is her in a white wife beater running
with low cut pants,
pants and tied up wife beater. Uh-huh. So it shows her tummy,
but it changes also where the knot is. Sometimes it's right in the middle, sometimes it's over the side,
but then somehow she always gets wet.
Oh yeah, she's soaking wet the entire time.
It is a Michael Bay movie. All right, that part didn't make any sense at all, but Leatherface eventually does find her in the meat locker, whatever, the farm, what do you call it? Like cattle farm area.
Yeah, that's not a farm. That's a butcher place.
butchering
it's like a
mill.
Factory butcher meat processing plant. And Leatherface just knows how to turn on the sprinkler with a twisted nozzle.
And it turns it off.
Because it looks
like her shirt got dry, Tony.
Gotta wet her.
Turn it back on. My thought was that Leatherface knew the ins and outs of this factory, but there was fresh meat. So clearly people work at this factory. And I don't think Leatherface runs the factory by himself.
No. And they also, in the prequel, it kind of begins with that meat plant shutting down. And the meat that we encounter with her is fresh, like you said.
Yeah. It's thousands upon thousands of dollars just sitting in there.
Yeah. There were a lot of fresh pigs in there.
Yeah.
And there was live livestock.
Yes.
And the dead cows. Yes. Like, what is going on in here? Wasteful.
But sorry, going back to the fella on the meat hooks, I was thinking that he eventually, for all the pulling up and tugging and falling back, and the guy eventually does come to terms. He's just like, you know what? Fuck it. Kill me.
Yeah.
And then she does that in the most painful conceivable way.
She did not kill him.
Listen, if I ask you, I made a note. If I ask you guys ever to kill me, please slit my throat. Ugh. Please don't stab me in the stomach because I know that that's going to take the longest time to die. Mm-hmm.
She only did it one time.
Yeah, and she left it.
And she felt so bad about that. But that was the last
if your lungs are punctured and everything else going on in your back, besides your leg is cut off, one blow to the stomach is
not
going to
kill you.
No, and it's going
to
take
hours. There's
a few ways that you can kill someone immediately, and that's not one of them.
No. That was terrible. Yeah.
And, I wrote down that she kind of killed all her friends. Not directly, but indirectly. I mean, there are a few kills from Leatherface that, because of her, they died.
Exactly. I literally wrote, Jessica Biel is what gets everyone killed in here.
Yep. Maybe that's why I don't like her.
Maybe.
She didn't want to abandon the body in the beginning of the movie.
Exactly.
Correct.
And so
she wanted to make up the hitchhiker.
Waiting for the cops to show up was also a big point that she didn't want to just leave the body there.
She let another friend lure Leatherface and he got killed.
Exactly.
All right. So towards the end of the movie, like whatever, the movie's pretty closely mirrored. When she then becomes the traumatized woman on the side of the road, mm-hmm. now it kind of makes more sense that she's kind of like doing all the math in her head. And she's like, my bad, you guys.
This was all my fault. And then it's just such a big disappointment that she doesn't get hit by that car and killed. It just pisses me off in this version. In this film, there is another scene that used to turn my stomach, but now does not upon rewatching it. And that's the fingernail
the
grabbing. Yeah. And that was a thing in the early 2000s that was in every film. Do you remember that? Everyone would like grab onto something and their fingernails
and the
would get ripped off.
Break off. Yeah.
It was like when everyone was getting hit by a car.
Mm. Oh, yeah. After Meet Joe Black, the effect really worked well.
And that was the fingernail time. And now watching it, I'm like, eh. Fuck it. I've seen this like 20 million times.
Yeah, it still kind of skews me out. But at this point, I watch it and resent the filmmaker.
Yeah.
In his collection of essays, The Return of the Repressed, Risen from the Grave and Brought Back to Bloody Life, Horror Remakes from Psycho to Funny Games, Nathan Lee writes, "The remake's fatal flaw is the lack of humor and sense of the absurd that gets leveraged against the brutality in Hooper's version. Beyond what Joy adheres in the craftsmanship, the sustained climactic gauntlet is a tour de force, Nispel drives only for a grim workmanlike nihilism." Now, yeah, we talked about it. There's a little bit of exposition in the beginning mm-hmm. where we get everybody's story. But after that, it's just kind of like run, 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 kill, avoid, right. avoid. And that's it. Like, there's not a lot of character to this film. Like, there's not character moments. And part of the reason I don't like the movie is kind of like, I don't give a shit about anybody who died
exactly.
or came close
yeah.
to dying.
Or that's And true. You're not even rooting for the bad guy either.
No.
You know, because sometimes yeah. you have that. You're like, well, I really like this bad guy.
Sort of like House of 1,000 Corpses. I kind of root for
oh,
the bad guys.
Oh, you definitely root for the bad guys.
But yeah, this one, you don't root for anyone.
No.
No.
You kind of hope that
everyone
yes,
dies.
Yeah.
I feel bad for Mike Vogel, and that's like the
yeah,
only
exactly.
part.
Me too. That was the horrific death.
Yeah. And then even that death is like overshadowed by all that Christ imagery. And it's so kind of annoying because she's like, forgive me. And she's at his bloody feet because he's strung up like, yeah. on the cross. And it's so like music video like.
Yeah,
cliche.
She kind of stays yeah, underneath him as the blood drips all over her. And she didn't find that kind of creepy or disgusting. She just lets the blood drip all over her face.
Well, that part might have been shock, where she's just like, I can't even right now. And by that, we mean get up and out of the blood spray.
All right, you know what? Let's find Kemper and get the hell out of here.
The next movie that's on our list of early 2000s remakes, 2005's House of Wax, which I've been wanting to talk about for a while because, again, there's another scene that turns my stomach. This one's directed by Jaume Colette Serra, written by Charles Belden, who did the original, and Chad Hayes doing the screenplay.
It was a Chad.
Of course, absolutely. This guy, though, we know him from the original Lethal Weapon, thank you very much, and The Conjuring 1 and 2.
Oh. Yeah. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And Colette Serra has gone on to do, like, The Shallows.
Yes.
Orphan, which, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm trying to get on the show pretty soon. And a bunch of Liam Neeson action movies, which
is so strange to me.
I'm puzzled. I guess they have a good working relationship, and so they just keep doing it.
They're all the same movie, I think. I've never seen
they
one
are.
Of these.
They are.
It's I don't know anything about it.
The newest one is The Commuter, which is the same move nonstop, which was on a plane. It's
but what's the difference between that and The Transporter? Are these different films?
The Transporter is with...
Well, Taken's a different...
With Jason Statham.
Right, but he drives. He's driving True. Around.
It's the public yeah. transportation version of The Transporter.
Like yeah. Speed.
But wait, they're all different. Kicking. They're all like, one's on a train, one's on a plane, one's on... Yeah. They're all just different vehicles.
Anyway, I'm not going to watch any of that shit. But here, he is doing House of Wax. This is a bizarre film because it has really nothing to do with the original House of Wax. It has nothing at all except for the font that we see on the House of Wax. it is also filled with some great CW stars. We got Chad Michael Murray. Yeah. Thank you. Alicia Cuthbert, which, remember when she was going to be a huge thing?
Right. She started Girl Next Door, and then everyone thought, oh, she's the next person.
Yeah. And she was on 24, too.
She was on 24 to Daughter.
Paris Daughter.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Paris Hilton, who was in the rise of Paris Hilton.
Yes.
At this point.
This was right
in
the middle of it.
Jared Padalecki.
Yes.
Who doesn't even look like Jared Padalecki, right? Did he have some work done?
No, it was him.
He beefed up.
He beefed up for Friday the 13th.
On the show Supernatural, well, I mean, it's the span of like 15 years. But so I do remember like young, thin Jared Padalecki. I guess he was also in Gilmore Girls.
Oh.
And he was awesome in Gilmore Girls.
So different than how you think of him now.
Yeah, yeah.
This was more of Gilmore Girls Jared.
Yeah.
Then,
mm-hmm. Yeah, they try and give him a little stubble to really...
That makes sense.
Give him some edge.
We got Robert Richard, who, I swear to God, he's literally my age, but in this movie, he looks so much older. That's Paris Hilton's boyfriend, and, like, he was in Coach Carter. It's just WB Central, it seems.
Have the older play younger. And,
of course. Yeah. But, I mean, he really wasn't that old. He was, like, 22 at the time, but on screen, he reads, like, 40. John Abrahams. Do you guys remember this guy? Because I see his face. He was in all the Scary Movie movies. He's
Scary Movie, yes.
Friend.
Yes.
Yeah, and Scary Movie was
he's
a
the one you feel
movie.
Bad oh, and he wants to have sex with Anna Faris, I think.
I don't remember. I literally haven't watched. I watched those movies in the theater.
Oh.
In the theater.
Okay.
In this, he's the guy with the video camera because every movie in this era needed a character who
carried a camera and filmed
everything.
Because people did that.
Yes.
Yeah, because we had a camera when we were in college, and we filmed everything. Because the Osbournes had just come out on MTV, and filming yourself was big shit.
Yeah, I guess it was.
But that kind of worked with this movie, I felt like, because of Paris Hilton.
Right, exactly. Because One Night in Paris was 2004, so it had previously been released, maybe when they were filming this, but it's written in, they do the green screen, the night vision scene. And you're like, I get it. I get what's going on.
But I like the Paris song. They kind of make fun of that. Which
it's true.
She's
a good sport.
I have mixed feelings because, I think like the blowjob joke early in the movie I thought was a specific reference.
Yeah.
And that she's not a terrible actress.
She's not the worst.
She's serviceable in this movie playing like a late teens, early 20s person.
Yeah.
Who's just generally vapid.
Yeah, and she doesn't... She's kind of one of the smarter people in the film, though, because
she
does not want to go on all these shenanigans.
No.
She's actually really smart.
Yes, she was.
Mm-hmm.
She actually had common sense out of all of them.
She really did.
Okay, so being the first actress that was signed on to this movie, they kind of used her to bankroll the rest of the movie and build upon it with the cast. And it seems part of those negotiations were using her catchphrase a number of times. So you could almost play a drinking game whenever a character says, "That's hot."
I knew to look out for that, but I didn't notice that at all.
Actually.
I didn't notice it either.
I didn't notice it at all.
That's weird.
It kind of grosses me out. Like that part, as far as the remakes being like a sign of a bankrupt system, like this is exactly that. But as it relates to like being a remake, which it is not, apparently WB. They went into production and even went as far as making posters with the original title, Wax House Baby. And kind of like Love Shack in that way.
Baby.
Baby. You can derive by the end of the movie, once you've gotten all the exposition, you've gotten all the villains' backstories, and we've made sense of the story.
Which, oh my God, they give you so much exposition.
Like
three times that you don't need it.
Yeah.
Just give it to me once. I figured it out. Show me that guy's wrist. I fucking figured it out. Yes. Done.
So Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I was kind of puzzled why they decided to make it a period piece even when remaking it. But in this case, we've got it modernized. It's meant to be 2004, 2005. But it starts out 30 years before with seeming twins, one of which is very well behaved at the dining room table in a high chair.
Yeah.
And the other one is a fucking maniac.
Savage.
And so you kind of get like, except we're not being shown anybody's face, so okay, red flag. But you kind of see that and assume like, okay, evil twin.
Right.
That's a jumping off point. All right, I'm game. The story's going to involve an evil twin.
But also that the parents are terrible.
Yes.
Yeah, because they're being very mean.
We went through all this trouble of separating you two, and this is how you reward us.
They were very, very mean to the bad acting kid.
Yes, they were. I mean, so they strapped him, and not a decent strapping. It was like hurting the kid.
Yeah, with duct tape and everything.
Yeah.
So the movie was produced by Dark Castle, founded in 1999 by Joel Silver, Robert Zemeckis, and Jared Bush. Dark Castle Entertainment's name is a reference to William Castle, the schlocky horror filmmaker from the 50s and 60s. Think movies like The Tingler and House on Haunted Hill. He produced a bunch of movies, some great, like Rosemary's Baby. When it first was formed, the plan for the movie production company was to remake Castle horror films similar to Platinum Dunes, who produced 2003's Texas Chainsaw Massacre and 2005's Amityville Horror. And the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot, which, I don't know, I think everybody's happy to never talk about again.
I've never seen it.
Me neither.
I've never seen it either.
Dark Castle Entertainment produced the remakes of House on Haunted Hill, 13 Ghosts, and the originals Ghost Ship and Orphan, which I'm eager to watch again. But in any case, this movie is really just borrowing the name from Vincent Price's 1953 version House of Wax, which itself was a remake of Mystery of the Wax Museum, which I watched, and I think I watched like a weird colorized version. Mm. It's a very short film, mercifully, but both the movies kind of capitalize on one scene where after the museum curator is horribly burned in an accident that was meant to capitalize on the insurance money, he essentially makes himself a wax facade. That's how good he is. No one notices we're talking to a wax-faced dude.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of these by the experts at Tussauds, and they look like monsters. So I'm not going to be fooled by the people.
It was just the animatic from... Is it the Hall of Presidents that Trump just got his face where he looks like they were obviously starting work on the Hillary design? And then, like we said before, would you recognize the person if all you had was their face pulled over someone else's face? And in this case, we have Trump's face pulled over Hillary's skeleton, and it looks as nightmarish as it fucking sounds. Yeah, I don't know. In my notes, it also says that this movie is more in common with the 1975 movie Tourist Trap. But like I said, the original idea was Wax House Baby, to give you an idea of the intended audience. This won all three Teen Choice Awards it was nominated for.
Sounds like it. Sounds about right.
Yeah, that's who this is for.
So we have our two main characters, Alicia Cuthbert and Chad Michael Murray, and they're twins. Except for one's a good twin and one's a bad twin, seemingly.
Dime me out.
I did not dime you out. When the sheriffs came to the house and asked me where you got the car, I said I didn't know. I didn't even know it was stolen. And you're blaming that on me?
You could have covered for me, huh?
You get caught for stealing a car and it's my fault. You're resisting arrest and it's the cops' fault.
Well, they took a swing at me, you know?
Look, get kicked off the football team, it's the coach's fault. Mom and dad kick you out of the house, it's their fault. You can't even keep a job for more than 2 weeks because it's every manager's fault.
I'm surrounded by idiots.
So why did you come? To piss me off?
Don't you get it? You're the good twin. I'm the evil one.
And they're going to a...
football game?
Football game?
Football game. Yeah.
But they're coming from Florida going to Louisiana for this football game.
Right.
It's very confusing. I don't understand the South. Honestly, I'm not good with the geography, so I don't... Is this a thing?
I'm not good with college football, but I know that it draws fanatics. And in this case, they are driving long, long ways and planning on camping overnight and then buying scalp tickets. Like, they didn't prepare
even have tickets. Yeah, they didn't even have tickets.
Yeah.
And then also, the guy has this big, huge Escalade.
Yes, he did. Well, both of them had pretty nice cars for college kids.
That's true. They're
both driving into like the nasty places of Louisiana.
Yeah, this doesn't make any sense. Anyway, I even wrote a note here and it said, were people dumber in 2005? There's nothing like supporting this. That was just a thought as the movie rolled out that I thought to myself.
I think it's one of the narrative cheats that when you make it so that teenagers are the prey in a horror movie, so much can be written off with like, they make stupid decisions. They're teenagers.
And they do.
What did you
they
expect?
Do make dumb decisions.
Yeah, they insert themselves in a number of scenarios that they easily could have avoided.
So they come across this campground first. We'll start there. They camp in the middle of nowhere. They're also navigating these back roads really, really well. And they decide to camp out. A local yokel comes and like shines their flashlights. That's all he does. He shines his headlights at them.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Chad Michael Murray is a dick for no reason. Throws a bottle at the guy.
He's kind of, and at this point, we've already gotten the exposition that he's done some time, I'm guessing in juvie. Well,
they graduated college. They're college seniors, from what I can gather.
Okay, so he should have been jailable, but someone gets him out of prison so he can make this trip and, I don't know, rebond
with
his sister.
And he wants to go on this trip for, I don't think we still know the reason why, right?
We never know exactly why. He's just there to bother Alicia Cuthbert.
Yeah.
But it seems like the other friend, who is not Dweezil Zappa, but kind of looks like a young Dweezil Zappa, that friend is the one who invited him along.
Right.
Right.
But that friend's not exactly friends with anyone.
Well, he likes Alicia Cuthbert's character. But
yeah, and I think he's friends with Coach Carter, kid.
Okay, so that's kind of...
But then why would you invite the brother if
If he
no
likes the sister,
him,
he could kind of convince her, like, you should hang out with your brother. We're all going to get him out of prison and take a road trip. Like, that sounds like something a dummy would try and sell you on.
Well, and all the exposition that they're giving me, they never gave me a reason why Chad Michael Murray was even in this movie.
No.
The movie does need a catalyst, and he is definitely the friend who gets drunk and gets into fights, and you're just kind of like, I didn't want tonight to be that kind of night, dude. Like, I don't want a fist fight.
There's always that one friend.
He's the one. He's the fucking troublemaker. About 42 minutes in, we are treated to the backstory and exposition from the town's only inhabitant, Brian Van Holt, playing Bo.
They still around?
No, it's a horrible story. Trudy's husband, Doc Sinclair, he was a doctor in the big city until he got his license revoked for doing surgeries on the side, you know, stuff that, you know, most doctors wouldn't dare do. So he moved him and Trudy out here to Ambrose, got a fresh start in his medical practice, and, you know, Trudy really found her calling with that whole wax sculpture thing. It was her dream to do something really incredible here. Then she had a couple of kids, pick a fence.
What's so horrible about that?
Yeah.
Trudy got a cyst in her brain. She just started rotting away. Couldn't work no more, and she went crazy. It got so bad that Doc Sinclair finally had to strap her to the bed. The whole town could hear her screaming from the house. And Dr. Sinclair was so depressed that he couldn't save her. He blew his head right off.
It was terrible.
It was worse for the two boys left all alone like that. They both ended up in foster homes.
When it was 42 minutes in, like, I checked the time. Like, I felt like this is taking way too long
to
become interesting. And when we do get to that 42-minute mark, he just tells the story of these twins on their way into town to get whatever, a drive belt or whatever for the car.
Yeah, a belt.
Fan belt.
Yeah, he wants a belt, which, P.S., it's a 15-inch belt, but he says, I'll take the 16 and make it work.
Right.
I don't think that works like that.
I don't know. Can you cut it?
No.
That's
the problem in the first place.
Well, then.
That's the problem in the first place.
I guess it would probably fall off and fuck up, right? You would just, like, every couple miles, you would have it.
You can't, like, shim it. It doesn't work like that. You can't shim a whole inch? No way.
I don't even know that term, so that's how prepared I am for this.
Anyway, that's just, it's ridiculous is what it is.
Well, I think his character is a little stupid anyway, because he's so curious about every place that he sneaks into every place.
Yes. Apparently locked doors mean nothing. Or signs that say don't come in here mean nothing to Jared Padalecki.
Yeah. Every door that's unlocked and open, he will go through.
Yes. He really will.
Okay, so I guess there is a woman at a window, but otherwise there's not really any sign that this town actually has people in
it. No, it's a pretty dead town when you walk through.
I'm going to say it's a 50-50 whether any of us would find themselves in their position and either figure, like, well, this is fucking cool. Like, this is a ghost town. These things really exist. I'm going to go explore. And or your reaction is, you know what? Nothing good ultimately will come of this except, you know, I'll have a story to tell about how I was almost killed.
You know, like, if I'm the person who finds, like, a door that's probably been painted over with blood for hundreds of years, I'm going to open it. So, I mean, I guess I'm annoyed watching him do these actions on the film.
But you relate to him.
I would totally do it. No one's there. No one's around. It looks crazy. I'd be taking pictures. It'd be crazy. Yeah, I'd be like, yeah, but you know what I would do? I'd make a phone call before. I'd be like, I'm in this really creepy house. Here's my coordinates. Send my location. And then I would say, okay, now in case I get killed because I'm going on this adventure.
I'm going to drop a pin.
This is me. This is my last sighting because this shit is cool.
On that note, as far as the cell phones that are present, and I appreciate that the movie does keep it contemporary on that level, they're all like vintage Nokia brick phones.
Yes,
far so.
I had one of those.
I know it's 2005, but every single one of those people would have had one.
Yeah.
But they don't all have them.
That's
only Alicia Cuthbert has it.
And Paris Hilton.
Flip Paris Hilton and the guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
This movie is almost 2 hours long. It's an hour and 52 minutes
long. Can we talk about one of the first like brutal things? Because I will say this movie is brutal as shit. Padalecki, for all his not following the rules and just wandering into whatever doors he feels, he gets it with a nice pair of scissors to the Achilles tendon.
That reminds me of Hostel.
Yes.
Yes, that's one of the worst, I think.
Yeah.
It's like just, pretty gruesome.
You can feel it.
I don't know why that, but that gets to me. I also...
Pet Cemetery.
Don't be afraid of the... Pet Cemetery with Gage. Don't be afraid of the dark. They go after the girl with the straight razors. But something about the cutting of the Achilles tendon, like, it really makes me, I tighten up.
Yeah.
My shoulders go up.
To me, it's not even the straight razor as much as, some reason, the scissors really, something about the scissor part of it, like, really, really bothers me.
And you just feel that you're incapable of moving after that.
Yeah. I think it is like an immediate helplessness.
Yeah.
And so, Padalecki, spoiler alert, he goes through the first where we see the entire transformation into wax monster sort of person. And he has the waxing from hell. They have to take all his hair off of him.
That was such a fascinating moment where that's how committed to, I don't know, wax figure authenticity he is that even he can't just use his own.
So much wax over him. I don't think it would matter that there's hair underneath.
No,
right.
It wouldn't even come out.
And even if you're, I don't know, he's not designing Padalecki to be someone else, so just wax the rest of his face around his eyebrows and just let his eyebrows be his eyebrows.
It would just cover them anyway. He had like an inch thick of like wax all over him by the end.
It wouldn't come through it.
Yeah.
Okay, and so not for nothing, if Padalecki is demonstrative of the other characters that are wax that we find around the town, it's done to him while he's still living.
Mm-hmm.
We are kind of popular culture leads us to believe that upon death, you release your bowels.
Yes.
Ooh.
And like even encased in wax, like this is a town full of people who have shat their shell. Like that's what would naturally happen. We don't get any, we get the sense of smell when they go camping and then they find these sort of compost of dead hunted animals at the bottom of the hill.
Because it's like a cheese. It's like entirely encased in wax.
I don't know, but I mean, the wax on him fell apart pretty easily. So I don't think this is like, it's not play. Like you're not meant to touch it. And so that's where he went wrong.
He's also injected with some paralyzing serum. That's incredibly horrific.
Oh yes. Hence the syringe that I confused for Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah. But I mean that whole thing,
the whole scene
is crazy. Yeah. And then when Dalton comes to save him,
wait, what the hell are you doing, bro? Man, come on. Everyone's waiting for you at the campsite. Wait. Holy shit, man. Hold tight, man. Hold tight. I'm gonna get you out of this. All right, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry.
And that is another instance. Thank you very much. Jared Padalecki on the piano, ladies and gentlemen.
Another.
Does he play chopsticks?
Well, yes, he does. But then when he is waxed, he plays nothing. He just gets his skin peeled off layer by layer.
Doing the Philip Glass at that point. Wait, no, not Philip Glass. John Cage. Oh, okay. So along the lines of the scissors to snip the Achilles tendon, later we get the finger snipping.
Yeah, that was an awful one, too.
Alicia Cuthbert puts her hands through. I love that whole setup because this movie, like, there's not... there's not like a killer with killer's weapons whose love is to kill. Like that's not the point. It's wax people.
Right.
So all the like tools used to mutilate people are just kind of common. They're a giant pair of scissors. Mm-hmm. They're fucking garden snippers that get used to snip off her finger in a moment that is not like – it's not gory and like over the top horror. It's just a moment of like – your fingers happen to be really delicate. Like, that's what fingers are.
See you
and I'm
later,
just
going to
snip, snip, and gone. And it was just so matter of fact that you kind of, it's shocking.
Even the way that she addresses it, too, when Chad Michael Murray comes to save her, she's like, watch out for my finger.
Yes.
You know, like, it's very, like, normal.
She's like
finger
don't touch
cut off. Yeah, just don't touch my finger. I'm cool. Let's go. She gets into it. When it's Paris Hilton's time, finally, when that time finally comes, Paris doesn't want to be there in the first place. She knows better. She don't want to be there. She knows she's going to get killed. Mm-hmm. She does. But when she screams, did you notice she screams like a 50-year-old woman? She's the weirdest scream. She's the worst scream queen ever.
Oh. Well, I mean, even as a scream queen, you know, they run around a lot, right?
Right.
She's the worst runner.
Yes, she is.
She's barely running. I mean, a killer's coming after
you. Will you try running
slowly,
in platforms,
like, treading
Tony?
Along. Come on.
Well, you should listen back to the scream. It's really bizarre because I think to myself, like, no, I don't like that. I don't like that at all. Also, my stabby great guy got a little foot stabbing,
which is
the story that I had been working on for a long time. But now here it was in House of Wax.
Okay, I know what you're talking about, but listeners don't know what you're talking about.
I had written this story, God, probably in high school, maybe? It was before House of Wax, all right? Anyway, it was about a man who stabbed up between the grates and stabbed people in the feet. And this was my stabby great guy here in House of Wax.
He's known as the nuisance of Fifth Avenue.
Because I think that what would be worse but then like walking on a grate and someone stabs you with a needle?
Yeah, yeah, the paranoia.
It's bad.
That
it's
falls.
Terrible.
Yeah. Oof.
Anyway.
But another gross thing was when Alicia Cuthbert's mouth got glued and she, to try to scream to get the attention of her brother, she had to rip open her own mouth.
That was gross.
That was a weird call to make.
Yeah.
Because also, I feel like she pushed her lips together really tight and like, I would just been like, bah, bah, bah. Like,
or like, try and squeeze your lips so you're only
it's the
doing,
littlest amount.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not the outer rim. I don't know. Yeah. The rest of the movie, it looked like she drank a lot of Kool-Aid. She's just got the red all around her lips.
It's like those kids you see in like neighborhoods sometimes and you're just like, God damn it. Your mom just drank Kool-Aid all fucking
well, it's
day.
Like drank Kool-Aid and did some Coke, you know, the white with the red.
Well, cause then she had gotten punched in the nose. So her nose was like busted as well. She took a good shot to the face though. And
she
kept
did.
On going.
Yeah, no, she deserves her survival.
There's many times in this movie where the double tap would have ended this movie very quickly. The first time when they shoot Bo with the arrow,
yes,
and they just leave him there. What the fuck?
Right. If a killer is coming after you, you kill. If you get the chance, you kill him first.
Of course. And then I'm sorry. You're in a crazy wax town where the wax is covering bodies of people. It's murder town now.
Exactly.
And I'm the fucking mayor.
It's a free-for-all.
I won in a landslide, you fuckos. I'm the mayor of Waxtown. What?
I'm the mayor of Murdertown, USA now, bitches. And I'm going to kill you. I'm not fucking around. I'm double-tapping like a maniac.
And speaking of that, they chose like one of the hardest weapons to use.
I know.
A crossbow.
Yes, why?
Yeah,
because
it was an impulse purchase at the window of the
but weren't
Army
they,
Navy
like,
surplus.
Or, I don't know.
I know. If I was them, they ran away from the ammo store. I think I would have run into the ammo store because there's probably more
guns,
weapons.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, everything's made out of wax, but clearly that was a real bow and arrow. So there was probably knives or who fucking knows.
But Chad Michael Murray was really good with that, but crossbow.
He was really good with that.
I would have missed.
Me too. I would have just tried to hit the guy with the arrow.
He catches him at least twice.
Yeah.
And then decides that's
it. And
then
they go pull them out. Like, you got to get those arrows back.
Yeah, you have no more arrows.
You literally have two arrows, dude.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway,
In the movie theater in the town, on the screen is playing Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so this movie really drives home the idea of siblings and or twins and duality. But it doesn't actually do anything with that as a theme. Like, we there's no insight to be found. It's just kind of a visual correlation that comes up from time to time. And, yeah, I don't know. It's not until an hour and 46 minutes into the movie, a time that the movie should have been well over, that we actually learn about why the brothers are weirdos. And this makes me think that the original script, it was nothing at all to do with House of Wax. Just shared that thing. I think, if memory serves, Warner Brothers didn't even realize that they had usage rights of the title. So there were even posters printed with Wax House Baby on them. Those are probably an eBay collector's item for Paris Hilton completists.
Well, I did like the music. That's something I can say that I really enjoyed. There was some My Chem in there, which was brand new in 2005.
I don't know who
My Chemical
was.
Romance, Deftones,
yep.
Disturbed made it onto. I mean, it was everything that was ever in early 2000s, right?
I remember they used to use the soundtrack as another means to get people in and generate more revenue with selling the soundtrack album.
Those 90s movies were great.
Dawson's Creek used. That's where you get music from.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Because at the end of the episode, they would say, "We featured this song."
Exactly. That's how they made money.
Yeah, and it was awesome. And that's how you learned about all the cool things.
Exactly.
Like Dandy Warhol's. So this ending, I'm not going to ruin it for you, but there's a Shyamalan. You're going to get Shyamalan'd. Tiny Shyamalan.
Let's talk about the sort of grand finale, because this crescendos beautifully in terms of the set design.
If you would have told me Michael Bay was involved with any of them, I would have said it was this one.
Yep.
It's a fucking inferno.
Yes,
it's pretty impressive. The set design and everything coming down around their heels looks great. It's terrifying. It turns out that they obviously didn't use all wax. They used a lot of peanut butter.
Here's the thing.
Which kind of grosses me
out. I have a kind of confusing thing. I know that the fire was really hot underneath it, but if the whole building was made out of wax, and this is in Louisiana. Louisiana is hot and terrible.
Hot and humid.
Yeah, why? If it was a hot day,
wouldn't
it
melt? This is the kind of wax that they use on M&M's. This is the coating. This is won't melt until it's in your mouth kind of wax.
I just kind of call bullshit on that. Maybe don't make a town out of wax.
Okay. I did have the question. I don't know enough about wax. Perhaps there is industrial wax, but after this, do all these characters now walk through a mall and have PTSD flashbacks when they walk by a Yankee Candle? It's too much wax to be beeswax. So, I don't know what else.
Oh, yeah.
Wax,
my other thought was, where all does wax come from? Yeah. And so, were they making their own wax?
Was he getting it?
I feel
ordering wax at this number, this volume, would have, red alert,
Right. The FedEx guy on his 15th trip is I'm going to call the FBI.
But then, according to the police, they're this town isn't even on the map anymore. It's been.
So, where is he getting his wax deliveries?
Right. Maybe who's
there's one P.O. box that, is just always overflow. The best idea I had was melting a shitload of crayons.
That's where the wax is coming from. Well, I thought wouldn't it have been cool if they had gotten the wax from bees and they were also beekeepers and then one guy could run out and get killed by bees.
I like that idea. And they do kind of hint if this movie was a success, then they sort of built in the...
That's the Shyamalan.
The Shyamalan moment that there could be more of these movies.
Which, P.S.
I like B-Town. I like your
B-Town
idea
is great.
That there's a whole
other...
I might enjoy that. Yeah, ghost town, but it's just inhabited by bees.
But that that original...
Like a sci-fi movie.
It does sound like a sci-fi movie. It's terrible. Terrible. Urkel's going to be in it. That original guy who picks up the roadkill, he's in the movie who I've talked about a lot called 100 Bloody Acres, Australian film. And everyone should watch it. It's a love horror story kind of romance comedy horror. Okay. And then the cop at the very end is from one of my favorite Australian movies called Garage Days. And cause I was looking at the cop going I know this guy. I know this guy from something. And he was in Garage Days.
Ah, that was a band movie. But
there's a lot of Australians in here.
You mentioned Australia. This was mostly filmed on a set in Australia. And that's relevant because The production was sued for $7 million because the big fire at the end spread and burned down part of the Gold Coast Warner Brothers studios.
Is that why there's no WB anymore?
The end. What is the WB now?
CW?
Yeah.
Or Pix 11.
I don't even know.
Yeah.
But okay, so before we started recording, we were talking about The Disaster Artist and The Room and Tommy Wiseau.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a possibility that the wax face brother, who's really doing the bulk of the work in this movie, his wax face, I think, is based on Tommy Wiseau.
You are lying. I never hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa.
He's also got a big fake head of black hair.
I think he's just trying to be like the Undertaker. I don't think it's Wiseau.
I can see the Undertaker.
Yeah, he's just
hiding behind
his hair. I can
see Undertaker, right?
He's a big guy too.
Yeah, he's kind of like Undertaker, but sort of like the Crow, kind of.
Yeah, the Crow.
I mean, you got to think 2005. What was I thinking about in 2005? Like Disturbed was a thing. Dark hair, long.
Yeah. I think
the Ring. The Ring had recently come out, so you got the long dark hair.
Yeah. I'm sticking with Tommy Wiseau. I think this was a nod. I think they kind of figured, like, his face already looks like it's made of wax. Okay, now, for The Hills Have Eyes, Nathan Lee writes, the familial chaos represented in Last House on the Left from 72, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Hills Have Eyes, and I Spit on Your Grave in 78 has widely been upheld as analogous to the breakdown in social order affected by the Vietnam War. So if the original Hills was a reaction to the Vietnam War, then no one should be surprised when the new one comments on the Iraq War. Normally, the city versus country dynamic of horror movies like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Deliverance, Wrong Turn, Tucker and Dale, they normally pit city folk, modern and hip, against rednecks or hill folk. We don't see a lot of horror in the desert. It's hard to make daylight scary. But it's a specific American environment that resembles the Middle East. And when it comes to Iraq, the message of a people put upon by the U.S. government, well, here we have the Jupiter family, a mining family who refused to leave their land when the government decides to use it for nuclear testing. A few generations after hiding in the mines, exposed to radiation, and they feel it's only their right to prey upon anybody driving through their domain.
Yeah, anybody at all. Let me hit you with some radiation facts.
Okay.
Right? Because I was looking into this because I'm afraid of people who live in the subways. You know, mole people, things like that. So I like to look into, like, mutants. Things like that.
Like X-Men?
Yeah, I'm not talking about, like, normal homeless people that live in the subways. I'm talking about the kind who never come out.
You're talking about,
like,
the X-Men, the
Morlocks. I'm talking
about,
like, the Dark Days style.
Like, they don't see a day of, like, light.
Exactly, and they only speak in train noises. But I was like, okay, what if there was this radiation? What would happen to people? Could they turn into these monsters that they showed? No, they cannot.
You mean they don't, like in the comics, get powers?
No, radiation is terrible, you guys. It's so not fun at all. You should have seen the pictures I was looking at. Mostly what you're going to have is your hair's going to fall out, probably, and foremost. I mean, you're going to get a nasty sunburn. That's going to be pretty nice. And if you don't immediately die, which it takes quite a lot of radiation to, like, immediately kill you, it'll maybe kill you in a year, but probably within 10 years, symptoms will still continue on with basic, even small-level radiation. And even then, you'll probably get some non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and die. So it's not good. Don't get radiation. You're not going to turn into a cool mutant at all. Most of the monsters, however, in this particular movie were modeled after Agent Orange.
Yeah.
However, there's one monster, my most favorite monster, who I love very, very much. And he actually is something you could get from radiation, even though his particular image kind of comes from an Agent Orange.
I'm gonna guess
kind of
he's
thing.
The fella in the wheelchair.
Yeah, he's the hydrocephalic fella. And you can get that from radiation. There's some people who have radiation on brain tumors, stuff like that, that will cause you to have some small amount of hydrocephalus. And then they can fix it with a shunt or whatever. But if it goes untreated, you can really turn into a really big-headed person. But yeah, Agent Orange is where most of these cool things come from, like the little webbed fingers or things like that.
Yeah, in the opening we're treated to like everything from nuclear testing to Agent Orange, mm-hmm. and presumably like depleted uranium also yeah. has some effect. And yeah, I don't know. It does start on that note of like, hey, remember all the nuclear testing we used to do on American soil? And I feel like a lot of people don't. Maybe that's why this movie doesn't feel modern and immediate exactly. But like, we stop worrying about nuclear threats. Like, we stop worrying about babies being born without limbs and stuff like that. Like, it's not a conversation that still gets had.
I think because we have it in a different way nowadays. Whereas you're not afraid of like thalidomide the same way. More now, people are afraid of vaccines and certain functioning disorders, maybe like different levels of autism. And that's more what we, because it's more immediate yeah. and everyone yeah. knows someone affected by it, probably.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of our modern like thing, because we don't have, you know, thalidomide like that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. So, The Hills Have Eyes, directed by Alexandre Aja, starring Ted Levine, Buffalo Bill yeah. himself, also Captain Stottlemyre from Monk. We've got Claire from Lost, Emily DeRavine, Kathleen Quinlan, and Aaron Stanford, who was Pyro in the second X-Men movie. And I guess he's a regular on the 12 Monkeys TV show. So, for those of you unfamiliar, here's a brief synopsis. A suburban American family is being stalked by a group of psychotic people who live in the desert, far away from civilization. That's your one-liner. That's your elevator pitch.
I mean, that's pretty much all there is to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the family dynamic is certainly, like, they are all of, like, upper-middle-class means. The dad is certainly a gun-toting Republican
yes.
that's kind of driven
yes.
home. This, like, cross-country drive with a newborn, that seemed like it was pushing it.
Yes, especially with the Airstream, like, towing the Airstream behind you.
Yeah,
But there's also some sort of thing going on with Buffalo Bill's character where he, like, was retired, but for some reason he had to go get a new job and he's starting a new company.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well,
Is what's kind of implied, is that money was tight.
Right, and that's why this Airstream is not, like, the top of the
luxury.
Line.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why the air conditioner is not working, but it's like, right. It doesn't really make sense to me. Then what does Kathleen Quinlan do? Like, what's her job? And now she...
Stay at home.
Oh, maybe.
Not mother anymore.
Yeah, exactly. All her kids are adults.
All grown, yeah.
Oh, I guess boy's in high school or something.
You can kind of tell, like, just from the parents' perspective that, like, they don't get to have the family all together. And this is a big to-do for them. And let's put it all at risk by going on off-roads... for a shortcut from the redneck gas station attendant who.
Now, you and Rachel
suspicious.
Did a drive like this a
did
year ago, right?
You stop by a
right?
lot of gas stations?
No.
With redneck people?
No. I think we were in Arizona. You were just in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Did you venture out?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. I mean, we didn't drive, but we.
No.
Yeah,
you went
we
to,
just
like,
took
Pahrump.
Cabs
everywhere. That doesn't count.
What happened?
You didn't venture out to the desert in a cab.
No, no, no desert.
You didn't even go to Pahrump.
Did you hike anywhere? Did you, like, how far out did you? No,
I'm not a hiker.
He hiked to the Britney Spears show.
I hiked to Britney Spears. That was the longest hike.
Going back to the cast for a moment, the mutants in the hills are led by character actor Robert Joy, who is the guy with the lip thing going on, and Greg.
It's a
injury.
No.
Cleft palate.
Cleft palate. Thank you.
Is it? It looked like a wound.
No, it's a cleft palate.
It looked like in True Grit.
That's how
Barry
they
Pepper
look.
Has that same.
That's how they look if you don't get them fixed like that. If it's not a severe one that has like the literal leaking into it. I went to school.
Oh, okay. Well, Robert Joy, he's still recognizable behind the effect. Greg Nicotero plays Cyst,
yeah.
who is the head clamp redneck. I kind of love that all the mutants in this movie are like snowflakes. They're all unique.
They are all unique. My thought, though, was like, who did these like surgeries on this? Especially because of this guy with the cleft palate. It's mm-hmm. like, it must have been a minor one because if you have the full open cleft palate, you're not going to live that long. It doesn't fix itself. Mm. So who's like doing the surgery on these mutants?
There is some utilitarian functionality. I'm thinking head clamp guy. Okay. If the wheelchair guy with the giant head that sort of folds backwards.
Yes. I love him.
Oh, if that guy's head was slightly smaller, you might see that with a head clamp, he could be mobile.
Right.
Yeah. And move around. So I think head clamp guy or cyst, Greg Nicotero's character, is actually far more delicate than he appears at first. I think that he kind of falls in line with the traditional idea of what happens when you're irradiated.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's all burnt up and and nasty like that. And he's also lost, apparently, like bone density to keep his head upright. I don't know. I'm confused on why he has.
I think it's just very heavy.
Maybe. You would maybe find, though, with these people, with their radiation, they might all have nasty, nasty goiters. Yet none of these people do. Maybe the hydrocephalic guy kind of, it appears like, but I think because his neck is foldy.
One giant goiter, that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a goiter from the neck
up.
But
that is something you would see in some nice radiation.
Okay, goiters. I remember a lot of these conversations being had after the Fukushima disaster. And, I mean, this movie's got some to say about nuclear testing, but my understanding is that Shin Godzilla, the reboot, you know, on the Japanese side, serves as an allegory to the mistakes that led up to the Fukushima disaster and the fallout from there. But yeah, I remember people talking about like iodine tablets and sort of being nervous about eating fish that might have been exposed to coastal waters and that kind of stuff.
I still am. Yeah, they were. I remember we had to send iodine over to our offices when we worked at that company that we used to work at. So I have a question for you guys. You're on this desert trip with your family, let's say, with your family.
Okay, nightmare scenario, horror movie already.
And your truck crashes just like this does. What do you do?
I think you got to go back to the last landmark you found. Mm-hmm. Venturing out.
You walk.
Into an aimless, maybe I'll find a road kind of scenario seems like a really bad idea.
Do you take your whole family or do you leave some and go with a small group?
They did an interesting thing in terms of like splitting the two male leads.
I would not do that.
No, you don't go
I didn't
alone.
Feel like it was a good idea. Yeah.
If you're going to split up, you split up in groups.
Even if you didn't know monsters were abounding, like you still don't go by yourself because it's very hot in the desert.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's the old saying? Like if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, you go with a buddy or I don't know how
is
it
is. Is that a saying? I like
I didn't know
that
was a saying.
That's a nice saying.
You go with
a
group.
Like, smart saying. They come out with a great idea and then suddenly like then they forgot that this idea was going on.
Yeah. Dad at least has a gun. He had two guns with him on
they
that road trip. That feels like he overpacked.
There were a lot of people though.
And he was a police officer and he's a Republican.
Yeah, so I would think he would have more guns.
I actually would think he would have more guns.
He looked like he would be a guy with more guns.
He had two handguns. He seems like a guy who would have like two handguns and a shotgun.
Yeah, that's what was missing, a shotgun.
I appreciated that he had taught his son how to use the gun, but not so well that the son wouldn't act like an ass and point the gun at his brother-in-law.
Yes.
Yeah. That seemed profoundly stupid to
me. That was profoundly stupid. Very, very, very dumb. They kick off this whole now adventure, now that they're crashed in the middle of the desert, with a prayer.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, when they were about to separate, they said, let's say a prayer.
And I said, gee, that really, really helped you
that
out.
That helps.
Whose side was God on? Where's your Messiah
Not
now?
Not their side.
considering the traditional, like, extreme circumstances we find in horror movies, there's actually very little prayer in horror movies, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
There's, in Deep Blue Sea, LL Cool J gives them a round table prayer on the, as they're filling up with water. But can you think of other moments in horror movies where, oh, there's a good one in 30 Days of Night where the woman is like praying, like the woman's about to be killed by the head vampire.
Yeah,
and
she
praying,
does. She prays to God.
And he speaks very few words of English, but like his muttering of God.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah.
That was fucking haunting.
Yeah.
But here it's a Republican family praying for their well-being, and it's not going to work out for a lot of them.
No, it didn't come in handy. Yeah.
That's it. Like, I love Ted Levine.
Me
I
too.
Really, yeah. I see him in this, and I'm rooting for him. I don't give a fuck. Republican, gun to, I don't care. You're Ted Levine. You're awesome.
Yeah.
And if you notice, he occasionally slides into the Buffalo Bill drawl.
Yeah. That's, I think, how he talks, and I kind of like it.
No, no, not always. When he's the captain and Monk, he's
pretty
proper.
That's true, he doesn't. But sometimes some of the things he says, and I'm like, what? What's that? And then I was like, you, mutants better watch out, because he's going to be wearing a cleft palate face soon enough. Sadly, that doesn't
happen. Hey, Dad, where's your... Oh, you're doing the tuck. You're doing the tuck as you...
Oh, we're dancing now.
You're listening to Goodbye Horses.
That would have been funny if that was on the radio. I would have done that.
What?
I noticed this family are terrible pet owners, and they don't deserve their pets at all, because they don't put the pet on a leash.
Nope.
Yeah.
Until the very, very end.
The pet always runs out.
Which I'm going to say it right now. I'm going to say right now. One of them dogs dies. One of them lives.
This movie is really hard on the dogs.
It is.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. You know how I don't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not comfortable with dog violence, then...
But without the dogs, they all would have died, I think.
Yes. But they, so yeah. It's like they just didn't even deserve those dogs. They didn't deserve their love.
The dogs are so prominent and important. I was thinking about it. In this scenario, given the option between a gun and a dog, I'm taking dog.
Mm-hmm.
I think the dog is... It proved to them to be far more useful than any of their handguns.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a scene even later, like later on, and we'll talk about it, where he leaves the dog kind of behind.
Yeah.
And lucky for him, the dog gets out and saves his life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That, take the dog. Always take the dog. Unless it's Murphy.
That guy did not deserve that dog's loyalty.
Murphy. No. Murphy's not going to do shit. He's going to come upon like that big headed monster, and he's just going to like cuddle up on his lap.
Or get punted. Oh, Murph, I don't want to see you get punted. Aww. Yeah. Better to hide. Better to hide. I forgot all about this, but I did want to talk about the opening. Like once we're... Like, barely through the credits, we are sort of exposed to this industrial dead man's landscape bomb testing area in the middle of the desert where scientists are in their hazmat suits and they're doing, like, water testing and checking for radiation levels. And in a brutal daylight attack, I guess from the POV of one of the dudes, we see, like, a pickaxe attack just tear through them.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of it, like, all four scientists are tied to the back of the truck and driven away.
Right.
Yes.
And, like, that shit was right out of the visuals from the Iraq War. The four contractors who were hung, like, that was a specific visual. And I was thinking, like, that... There's no subtlety to that one. Like, that's a memory he's drawing from.
Also, at the beginning, before their car breaks down and everything, they come upon this gas station in the middle of nowhere, and he's the one who essentially leads them into this trap, blah, blah, blah. But this gas station in the middle of nowhere, when Buffalo Bill comes upon it the second time, when he has walked back to it, he also, like Jared Padalecki, is very snoopy, just walks right in, and then opens a styrofoam container. Why are you opening a styrofoam container? That's that guy's leftovers.
It probably smelled out of context, like out of the fridge. But it probably had a smell to it.
Everything, though, smelled, though, because it was all filthy.
No, but he was a cop, so he's intuitive, and this is just a fun fact for you guys.
Open that.
Police officers commit crimes at the same rate as the rest of us.
That's true, I suppose.
But that's one theme that I saw in all three movies, a creepiest gas station.
Yes.
Why are you, if you're going to stop at a gas station and it seems creepy and a gas attendant is creepy, just go.
Keep going.
Just go.
I only go to brand label, brand name, gas.
The only time like a gas station in the middle of the desert was good, it was in 100 yards over the rim.
The Twilight Zone episode we talked about on our Patreon. So a thing happens that like I don't know how I feel about it. I just notice it, and I guess it does kind of annoy me. But every once in a while in a movie, you get, like, a deep wave of exposition for a character. Mm. And that character then dies, and none of the other characters ever inherit that information. And so that moment really just was for the viewer. It's like, oh, thanks for catching us up. Sorry that person had to pay for it with their life.
Right.
But let's move on now that we have the facts.
Right, and it is literally for that. These three movies in common share ridiculous exposition.
Yes.
Like, why are you telling me so much? I can put it together.
Figure it out,
all on my own.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where that comment came from. Was everyone dumb in 2005 and needed these huge expositions that they couldn't, like,
needed
piece
to
it together?
Everything.
I think because maybe less so The Hills Have Eyes, but the other two were certainly, like, we are trying to get teenagers into a theater. And so they kind of talk down to them.
Yeah.
They are having to, like, we can't organically have conversations because people stop listening, or at least whatever fucking tweens stop listening. So we have to, like, chop out a 2-minute block where we explain what the fuck is
everything.
Going on.
Yeah, because here, even this note here, I wrote, good thing there's this drunk old man and newspaper clippings to let us know what's going on.
Yep. Yeah, we, like, get the full picture.
I don't need to know. I know there's monsters in them there hills. That's all I need to know.
And we do get that guy again. The gas station redneck is back. So, like, yeah, he could have said a couple words of regret reflecting upon all the, like, years of atrocities he's condoned and sort of, you know, contributed to. But that's not what that scene is about. It's about him blowing his head off.
Right.
In the outhouse. Like, he chose that location. It was kind of, I guess that's an admittance of, like, I'm shit. I've been shit my whole life. I'm dying in the outhouse.
Yeah, why would he go out there? I don't know.
The smell can't get any worse.
I don't want to be next to that ear that you're snooping around by. So Big Bob, or Buffalo Bill, at this point in time, spoiler alert, he gets got. He gets got by the monsters.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He gets it, like, sort of twofold, where we...
Yeah.
We kind of assume he's dead, and then that's driven home by a human bonfire.
Right.
He's the burning bush.
He's a very good distraction.
Yes.
Because while that's going on, there's a rape-in happening.
That was hard to watch.
Holy shit. Brutal.
Did we all watch the unrated director's cut?
Of course. When you're given the option between rated and unrated, you're going to watch the unrated.
I haven't seen the rated version, but I'm guessing that this scene is
edited
down.
I've seen the rated version. It's quite edited down.
Really?
And you don't get that she was raped.
Really?
You just get that she's traumatized.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. And the the breastfeeding scene, I'm guessing that wasn't there as well.
A little bit.
Yeah.
You get a little bit of it.
I don't remember the unrated one.
Yeah.
I mean, the rated one.
I don't think I saw it. I saw this for the first time, like, a couple years ago when I was vacationing with my parents in Florida. Not vacation. I was staying at their home. And...
You didn't watch it with them, did you?
I sure did. And that's on me. That's my bad. I should have known better. I should have... Who was I to think that there wouldn't be adult-on-adult breastfeeding? Forcible breast... It's fucked up. It's really... Yeah. It really bothered me.
Yes.
It really bothered me.
Yeah. That's one of these, like, where I wanted to watch this with Jackson just because I had to watch it. And I was like, oh, you want to watch it? He goes, no, I'll watch the other two movies, but I don't want to watch that one. And it was because of the rape scene.
This was the one I was dreading out of the three.
Yeah. I put that aside, much like Snowtown Murders. And I like the monstery part of it so much that I just compartmentalize that.
Yeah. I was thinking in terms of horror movies, it's pretty rare that we get movies made during daytime because whatever, there's no shadows to hide in, all that shit. But the music in this case by Tom and Andy does a lot to, like, drive home the atmosphere. And then it's moments like forcible breastfeeding by a mutant with a cleft palate. No offense to people with cleft palates, but in this case, like, it's used for, I don't know, like a devious effect. And, like, those moments of making you cringe and really uncomfortable and betraying this maternal standard that, like, I've never seen it before. I never want to see it again.
Yeah, this was very much like French Extremity testing out the waters of America to be like, how much can you guys take? Because we're doing all this crazy shit over here in France. Now you guys look at this, and Aja does it. And you even see it with the color palette. It's the same color palette as High Tension. It's that browny, warm colors. And not just the gore, but the uncomfortableness of the entire thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know how British comedy exists to make you feel really uncomfortable?
Not exclusively, but The Office, the original Office, a lot of cringe humor.
Yeah. And, like, in-betweeners where you're just like, oh, God, I feel really uncomfortable. This makes me, but I'm laughing.
Like, it's hilarious,
that's what Aja is doing for horror. Is
but you never laugh at the end of this.
I joke that this has
the rewatchability of Requiem for a Dream. And you guys just described it a moment ago. You were like, this is the one I was not looking forward to rewatching. It's like we watched it once. It impacted on us, and that's fine. Like, let's walk away. But let bygones be bygones, and not have to suffer through this fucking thing again. But I think, like, the reasons this works is why this is, I think, the strongest of these three movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stay back there. He's keeping an eye.
one of my notes in this, I wrote many notes. Most of the notes in this were like how to survive these kind of situations in my brain.
When you're face down with a...
Exactly. And my note on this was the moral of this story is to murder everyone when you're dealing with mutants in the wild. Murder everyone and use Ash's idea of shoot first, ask questions never.
So you don't need to know why they're doing it.
You just go.
You just...
Slash
There's
and
no
hack.
Stopping to read a newspaper. It's like, what exactly was their motivation?
Yeah.
We don't
like,
care.
I don't care. I am hacking and slashing. I'm keeping all my weapons with me.
Yes.
Like, there's a lot of times where they use a weapon and then drop it.
Drop them, yes.
Like, that weapon's still usable.
Right.
House of Wax did that a lot, too.
They did.
With things, and you're just like, keep that.
Yeah. There were a lot of weapons around.
Yeah.
But they don't take them. They just leave them after they use them. No.
That's very dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. And here we get the transition... Aaron Stanford, I don't remember what his character's name is, but he's the yuppie young dad.
Doug.
We kind of see his transformation in the way, like Dustin Hoffman in Straw Dogs, where like he never left that van, truck and trailer with the intentions of being a fucking action hero.
Right.
But here we are.
Yeah.
And he, like, we kind of watch him devolve at the same time. And so by the end of it, like, he's no different than the murderous rednecks in those hills.
What are you talking about?
He's not eating
people, and he had to save his baby.
He's protecting them. He's not purposely killing
them. I'm just saying
for the fun of it.
It's him and the dog against the world.
It's a level of savagery where, like, he's not familiar. Like, old Doug... is a long ways back. Like,
right.
He becomes something else, which he needs to in order to survive.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a survival of the fittest at that point. And I think he totally did what Big Bob
would have wanted him to do.
Exactly. Because he was pretty much a pussy.
Right. Exactly. Because he calls him a Democrat who doesn't know how to use his gun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in the end, he kills a lot of them.
Yeah. He does really well. Yeah. Like, I was really proud of
Doug.
He was
tough.
Yeah. For a cell phone salesman.
What? He got ass.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, I thought it was funny that his character was kind of bearded. I did get the feeling that, like, very similar to Ryan Reynolds the next year in Amityville Haunting, that without the beard, he looks 12 years old.
Yeah.
And in here, he's supposed to be, like, young dad coming into his own. But, yeah, I feel like, he would have looked like a child among
and then
adults.
A situation occurred, and it makes me think, like, ugh, I should always have extra contacts with me, where his glasses get thrown off and broken and stuff. Listen, if I only had my glasses and they got broken, I would be fucked, you guys. Yeah. I wouldn't know anything.
Blind, right?
If anyone comes in front of me, you're getting shot, because I can't see the difference.
Does your go bag have an old pair of glasses? Mine does.
No, mine does not.
Your glasses are far more expensive than mine, so they have to be a little
I have
accessible.
One pair of glasses at
Well,
a time.
You just need to go to the glasses store, tell them you need $1 pair of glasses.
Yeah, but they're like crazy special. They would literally
because
be
I have,
the
so
thickness
thick.
of Coke bottles.
Yeah, my glasses are like, so thick that they have to like, you have to spend extra money to make them thin. And still, even with the thin ones, I'm using
so
air quotes, they're still too thick for certain frames.
Wow.
So go there. So if my glasses got broken, would be over. It would be over. I would just sit down and cry.
Just shoot everyone.
Yeah. I don't know if you have them now, but the like nerdy rubberized ends so they don't fall off your head. You should invest in those and have those nearby as
well. I think this like at home invasion movies, because if you wake me up in the middle of the night, I ain't got shit. Because my contacts are not in. I would have to, like, reach for my glasses.
Oh, your glasses you don't even keep near the bed?
I mean, like
you do
kind
your morning,
up high.
But she has to kind of go
But you do your morning routine without your eyes, essentially, until you get your contacts in?
No, the first part of my morning routine would be to go put my contacts in.
Okay, but I'm saying, you wake up essentially blind, legally blind.
Yes, yes.
That's terrifying. That
it is really,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
That
no,
weird?
Rachel has to, like, feel her way around the apartment, like, if she
I'm
gets
like
up.
I'm like Velma. It's horrible.
She'll always be on the floor looking for glasses.
Scrawling around. Yikes. Like, where's Mindy? Oh, she's crawling around again.
Jeepers.
Where's my daughter? Where is she? Answer me.
I don't know where she is. I never leave this place. Our people asked our families to leave their town, and you destroyed our homes. into the mines. You set off your bombs and turned everything to ashes. You made us what we've become. Boom. Boom. Boom.
Where's my baby?
So without giving any more spoilers, I suppose we'll end it here on the remake of The Hills Have Eyes, which I think I did want to do last and save, because this is one that, like, it, despite it really, really getting under my skin, I like this one a lot. Like, this is a better film than most of the remakes.
Yeah, I mean, these three, the thing is, you have to watch them at surface value. Don't expect anything you've never seen before. Because you're not going to get it.
But
just have fun. Watch the CW.
I feel like that's kind of a cop-out. Like, that's almost what the studio would say in terms of, like, you didn't need to have seen the original to appreciate this one, which is to say we paid no care. We paid no mind to the originals in duplicating these films.
I don't know. I don't think that's the worst thing in the world.
No, it's not. I mean, I enjoyed a little bit of it just for, like, the fun factor and, you know. But other than that, you're not looking for a great story.
Right.
You're not looking for, like, kills you haven't seen before.
Really, I'm not going to get them. Yeah.
You're just enjoying what they're giving you.
Yeah. I think it's a fun... These movies were made, I think, to be go into the theater and see it, because you've been watching these people on the CW for the last, like, whatever. You go see them do sexier things that they're not allowed to do on CW, or more violent things, and
do you want to see your favorite team heartthrobs murdered?
Exactly. I sure do. So you just watch it for the time being and enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah.
So we'll end it there. We do want to give a big thank you to our Patreon patrons who make this all possible. We don't shout them out nearly enough, but over on patreon.com/rantsmacabre, you can find a whole other catalog of material that has never appeared on the mainstream. Mainstream, I like that. But check it out. We've got everything from original music to mini episodes to full episodes. We've got a science report on the science of fear.
Yeah.
There's a lot there, so give us a look. Otherwise, we're on all the other social media, of which Tony gave us a start on Instagram, which reminds me we've neglected. We need to get right back to
it. We do neglect Instagram.
But we are at Rants Macabre on all social media platforms, except for Snapchat. I think I kind of imagine at this point, like, we've neglected Instagram to a pretty...
Do you want to start a Snapchat?
I feel like Snapchat is for sending
only
pictures
of your
boobs.
Only if you exclusively do it. Like, if you want to take Snapchat on, like, I'll send you all... I don't know.
I just feel like it's for kids to send, like, naked pictures to each other.
You don't have to, right?
No, you also give yourself bunny ears. And
I do like those bunny ears filters.
Yeah.
And you could switch faces with, like, Leatherface.
Oh, that might be cool.
Is that a...
Yeah, you could switch faces.
I hadn't thought
about
it.
With each other.
You could totally
that would be really
that.
Creepy.
That would be really creepy.
Okay, you could totally pull a Leatherface on Snapchat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I like it. We might look into it.
Don't look at me. I'm not doing that.
But thanks for joining us, Tony.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll have to have you on sooner than I think the last time you were here was for director's commentary. Listen
to me.
We're
the director.
Yeah, for Deathgasm, we all did a podcast commentary. But yeah, we'll have you back soon. We'll have to think of a good subject. But yeah, that'll do it for me. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
This is Tony. Thank you.
The Rants Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated.